Wondery Plus subscribers can listen to The Vanished ad-free right now. Join Wondery Plus in the Wondery app or Apple Podcasts.
Dad had a schedule. He got up in the morning, he had a cereal, he went and did his errands, run to town or to go visit other elderly people or whatever he needed to do, and he was home 2-3 o'clock in the afternoon at the latest. He'd had to have his afternoon nap. Well, this got to be 3 o'clock and Mom started to get a little nervous. We didn't really think too much of it yet. We weren't too worried about it, but they were married for 50 some years, so they were pretty in tune to each other. So she started to get a little frantic, so we decided we better maybe go drive. I drove in town to go see if I could run into him or if he was along the road somewhere or whatnot. My brother, Franz, he went in a different direction.
I think somebody did something to my dad. I have no clue who or why. Like I said, my dad would stop and pick up a hitchhiker or help somebody who needed help. He had to have stopped for some reason on his way, you know, after he left the grocery store, in order for anybody to have gotten a hold of him and to have the car stashed like that.
On July 24th, 2009, 82-year-old Peter Ackerman was last seen in Staples, Minnesota. He had left his home to run errands, and he was spotted driving around town. Peter's wife expected him to be home between 2 and 3 p.m. that day, but Peter never returned. The following day, Peter's 1995 Chevrolet Caprice station wagon was found about 10 miles from his home, near a wooded area, and his car was stuck in the mud. Inside the vehicle were the groceries and medication that Peter had picked up for his wife the previous day. However, the car keys and Peter's cane were missing. According to Peter's family, he was in good health and wasn't experiencing any type of medical issue that would cause him to be confused and wander off, nor do they believe that he would have any reason to walk away from his family. What happened to Peter Ackerman on July 24th, 2009? This coming July, it will be 10 years since Peter disappeared. And after all of those years, his family hasn't gotten any closer to solving the mystery of what happened to him. Last summer, they decided to have a funeral in celebration of Peter's life, to help bring them some sense of closure. But the questions still remain. I'm Marissa, and from Wondery, this is episode 157 of The Vanished, Peter Ackerman's story. Audible offers thousands of popular favorites, exclusive new series, guided wellness programs, comedy, and exciting new voices in audio. As an Audible member, you can choose one title a month to keep from their entire catalog. The Audible app makes it easy to listen anytime, anywhere, while traveling, working out, walking, doing chores, you decide. I like to listen a little bit each evening while I'm cooking dinner, and it's great for my evening walks too. Recently, I've been listening to Lay Them to Rest by Laura Norton. It's a fantastic audiobook. You don't want to miss it. New members can try Audible free for 30 days. Visit audible.com/MIA or text MIA to 500-500. That's audible.com/MIA or text MIA to 500-500. Back in August, I was contacted about covering Peter's case by one of his daughters, Renee. With Peter's case, we had a unique opportunity. Peter had also written a memoir about his life. So not only did we have interviews with his family to go off of, but we also had his life story, written in his own words. His family was able to mail me a copy of his memoir, titled The Journey of a Lifetime. Peter Ackermann was from Switzerland. He was the second-born son out of four children in Neuhausen, which is a small town within Schaffhausen, Switzerland. Growing up, he tested his mother Berta more so than her other children. While a good child for all intents and purposes, Peter was a touch louder, rougher, and more stubborn than his other siblings. Despite that, he was close with his parents, brothers, and sisters. Peter longed to be a farmer from a young age, but his mother and some of his other relatives weren't sure why he was drawn to such a laborious career path. They didn't understand the allure of such work. However, to Peter, this was everything. He stated that he longed to go back to his ancestral beginnings of tilling one's land himself and caring for livestock. For Peter, it was difficult to find work in this field in Switzerland. He couldn't afford to purchase a large amount of land, and most farmers were born into the work. So in 1948, when Peter was around the age of 21, he left Switzerland and emigrated to the United States. At this time, the United States was looking for people from other countries to come help with agriculture, due to the fact that many farmhands were moving on to better-paying jobs after the war. To get a better understanding of who Peter Ackermann was, we spoke with one of his sons, Jörg, for this episode. Here's Jörg speaking about his father in his youth.
He was a Swiss immigrant, so he was pretty courageous. He came from Switzerland in 1948 after the war, lived through Hitler and the Germans right next door to him in Switzerland, and he wanted to be a farmer. He wanted nothing more than just to work the land and have animals, and in Switzerland you couldn't do that unless you were born into it. You know, you couldn't afford the property or anything else, so he was going to America. He was very brave. He was 19, I think, when he 21, somewhere in there, when he showed up to the United States all by himself, didn't know the language. He got jobs, odd jobs on farms, and made his way from Illinois up to Minnesota, where he eventually met my mom. He bought some property not far from where she grew up, and they met and started to date and married, and he had 11 kids with her. He had a big family. He was happy. He was he was living his dream. He was a very religious man, Roman Catholic to the end. He God-fearing man. He was a good dad. He taught us all right from wrong, even if sometimes we didn't follow the advice or follow the teachings. And he made it known that we were expected to act one way, and that was with God in mind and God and family.
Coming to America wasn't easy for Peter. He missed his family and friends greatly, but he knew it was something that he had to do to pursue the life that he wanted. Being apart from loved ones wasn't something new for Peter. By the age of 16, he had left his parental home and spent time at three different farms. During his time at the farms, Peter took part in a two-year agricultural apprenticeship. The knowledge he obtained and the hard work he put forth during this apprenticeship prepared him for the labor he was about to do in America. After his apprenticeship, he took part in his mandatory military service. He spent this time as a gunman for the Swiss Army. By the time Peter had to enter into the service, the war was nearing an end. However, Peter enjoyed most of his time in the military. In his memoir, Peter wrote that military service within the Swiss Army taught him social acceptance and the understanding of cooperation. In 1946, before Peter made his way to America and after his military service had ended, he spent some time in southern France looking for work on farmland. He spent many months there, expanding his knowledge when it came to farming. One day, Peter got a call from his aunt asking him if he would come help her with some landscaping work. During his visit with her, she told him about a trip she had taken to America. This story, and with her encouragement, Peter made up his mind to go to America to see the farmland there. His aunt told him, "You may always come back, shouldn't you find a future there." This was advice that his aunt would say to him regularly to ease his worries about taking such a far journey away from home. Peter applied for an immigration visa, and through connections his aunt had in the U.S., he obtained a job on Fred Lauterbach's farm in Plainfield, Illinois. Peter had a plan, and although he was nervous, he was excited for what the future held. On December 23, 1948, Peter Ackerman arrived in New York. He was aboard the SS Washington with other immigrants and refugees from a slew of different countries. They all gazed upon the Statue of Liberty for the first time. Peter observed the emotions of those around him. Some cried, laughed, and even sang they were so happy to be in America, the land of the free. Peter knew that some of the people he had spent time with on this ship were not as fortunate as him. He had a good life back in Switzerland, with a close family and good friends. Some of these individuals were not as lucky as him. He was grateful to have the opportunity to pursue his dream of being a farmer in another country. As for the immigration process, Peter spent the next 2 days traveling to the Lauterbach farm in Plainfield, Illinois. From that moment forward, Peter was a farmhand whose day would start at 2:30 in the morning and end at 5:30 in the evening. It was hard work, but it was rewarding. During his time there, he worked on learning English by reading the paper and listening to the radio. Peter longed to interact with new people, and he knew in order to do that, he had to learn to speak their native language. Unsurprisingly, Peter got homesick, and some of his expectations of the work were not met. He wrote home frequently to his family, telling them how different American people farmed versus the Swiss and French. Peter was only contracted to work at the Lauterbach farm for a year. Once his time was up, he was eager to move on to another place. Peter spent some time working on dairy farms in California, before eventually winding up in St. Paul, Minnesota. Peter worked on a farm there. It was hard work that Peter handled most of the time by himself, milking cows and trying to maintain about 100 pigs. Peter also wasn't prepared for the harsh winters of Minnesota. Despite it all, he persevered. Every once in a while, when he wasn't needed on that farm, Peter got hired to work a day or two at a neighbor's home to do things like maintenance and fencing. On one particular day, Peter helped out Harry Voigt with such tasks. At some point, Peter met one of Harry's daughters, Delaine. It didn't take long for Peter to become infatuated with this beautiful young woman. She was only 16 years old at the time that they met, and Peter was in no rush to advance their relationship, but there were feelings there between the two of them. Over time, the pair grew closer. Through the ups and downs of life, they supported each other, and the love grew deeper. On April 13, 1953, the pair got married. Fast forward over 50 years, and the pair remained just as in love as they were back in 1953. Through different jobs, hardships, and the raising of 10 children and 13 foster children, the couple took on the world as a team. To the Ackermans, family was everything. July 24, 2009 was as normal as any other day in the life of the now 82-year-old Peter Ackerman. But what his friends and family didn't realize is that this day would change the course of their lives forever.
Well, the morning, July 24th, 2009, pretty much started like any other morning. A beautiful summer day in Minnesota. I was building a house about 2 miles away from the family farm. And that day I took off a little early before lunch to bring some material back home to the house. And that was the last time I seen Dad. I went over to the farmhouse from my place across the yard, and he was going to go into town. He had to meet my brother Mike, who lives in Montana. He was back for my sister Desiree's daughter's wedding, which was to be held that day, the next day on Saturday. So he went down to Motley, Minnesota, little town, to the cafe to meet my brother Mike. Then he was going to bring some money to my sister Desiree for the wedding, and then after that he was going to pick up some milk, which he did every time he went to town. He laughed sometimes and said that he had to bring milk home for the babies. He was an 80-year-old man, and his babies were in their 30s and 40s and 50s, but he was still proud to bring home the milk. So he went over to Staples, the town over, to get Mom's medication, some things from the grocery store. And that was the last time anybody had seen him. We have video from the grocery store surveillance camera of him loading up his cars with groceries, and that was last he was seen.
According to the family, Peter had a set routine. So the fact that he was seen in town running errands and doing this, that, and the other was not uncommon. What was unusual was the fact that he didn't return home around 2 p.m. that day.
Dad had a schedule. He got up in the morning, he had a cereal, he went and did his errands, run to town or to go visit other elderly people or whatever he needed to do, and he was home 2 or 3 o'clock in the afternoon at the latest. He had to have his afternoon nap. Well, this got to be 3 o'clock, and Mom started to get a little nervous. We didn't really think too much of it yet. We weren't too worried about it, but they were married for 50-some years, so they were pretty in tune to each other. So she started to get a little frantic, so we decided we'd better maybe go drive. I drove into town to go see if I could run into him or if he was along the road somewhere or whatnot. My brother, Franz, he went in a different direction, and I went into town and stopped at my sister's. They were having a wedding rehearsal at the church and seen if they'd asked if they'd seen him or heard anything from him. They hadn't. I drove over to the next town and didn't see nothing, so I drove back home up to the farm, about 30 miles, 25 miles up back up to the farm. And by this time, we were all getting a little worried, so we called the sheriff's department. We're pretty rural here where we're at, so the sheriff's, you know, we know who the sheriff is. They know who we are. They come driving in, and they told us that they really couldn't do much about the missing persons until it was 24 hours or it was till the next day, but that they would take the report and they would let other deputies know to keep an eye out for them and everything else. So after they left, we decided, well, we better go look again. So me and my brother, Franz, we got in the pickup and headed into town, stopping at some of his clients' places on the way there. And we got into town and nothing. So we drive through the hospital parking lot, see if his car is there. Maybe he's had to go to the emergency room or something. And we drove through the hospital parking lot, nothing. And we drove around that night till, I don't know, it had to have been after midnight by the time we got back home. So it was a short night till the next day. We got up the next day and still nothing, no dad. So we, well, what can we do? We got to at least go out, drive around and see if we can see his car. So we drove around. We came within about a mile of where the car was eventually found and when we were driving around looking. But it was out on a little minimum maintenance road somewhere where I'd never even been down that trail until that event. So we went home again after finding nothing, and we had our niece's wedding that day. So we got home. I got ready for the wedding, and Mom and decided she couldn't go anywhere. She had to stay in case Dad came home or he called. Or this was 2009. Cell phones were out, but they weren't really popular with the older people yet. Mom and Dad, neither one of them had a cell phone. She was going to stay home and sit by the phone and wait. So Franz decided the best be that he would stay with her, and I went to the wedding. So we went to this wedding, which was supposed to be a happy occasion, which really wasn't very happy at all. Everybody was feeling his presence missing, so it was sad. After the wedding, they had the reception at my sister's house. So everybody from the wedding went out to my sister's place right on the edge of town in Motley, and we're having the reception started out, and I got a call from a friend of mine that I had let him know earlier that Dad was missing to keep his eyes out for him, and he was going to let other people know that Dad was missing and to keep his eyes out for him. And he called me and said that he had a call from somebody or had spoken to somebody that had seen a car out on the minimum maintenance road abandoned and thought that maybe it was his. So I let my brother-in-law and my sister know that I had to go and check into it.
We all know there are things in life that you have to compromise on, but when it comes to your health, there's no compromise. So don't settle for that one doctor that isn't really addressing your needs. Instead, check out ZocDoc, the place where you can find and book doctors who will make you feel comfortable. And you can even search by location, availability, and insurance. ZocDoc is a free app and website where you can search and compare highly rated in-network doctors near you and instantly book appointments with them online. Once you find the doc you want, you can book them immediately. You can filter specifically for ones who take your insurance, are located near you, and treat basically any condition you're searching for. The typical wait time to see a doctor booked on ZocDoc is between just 24 and 72 hours. That's it. I use this and you should too. Go to ZocDoc.com/vanished and download the ZocDoc app for free. Then find and book a top-rated doctor today. That's ZocDoc.com/vanished. ZocDoc.com/vanished. This message is sponsored by Greenlight. When you're a parent, you'll have your fair share of big talks with your kids. One of those big talks should involve money, and Greenlight can help with that. Greenlight is a debit card and money app for families. You can send your kids instant money transfers, get real-time notifications of spending, manage chores, and automate allowance. I've been using Greenlight with my older two kids for years. One thing that I love about it is that I can set up recurring or one-time chores, customized to my family's needs, and then my kids earn an allowance to reward them for a job well done. Not only does it motivate them to actually get the chores done, but it also teaches them a bit about financial literacy and independence. They're learning to earn, save, and spend wisely. So stop putting off the money talk and start putting your kids on the right path. Sign up for Greenlight today and get your first month free at greenlight.com/vanished. That's greenlight.com/vanished to try Greenlight for free. One more time, that's greenlight.com/vanished. Peter's blue 1995 Chevrolet Caprice station wagon was found about 10 miles from his home. The station wagon was located near a wooded area, and it appeared that his car was stuck in the mud. This trail was not the typical path that Peter would take to get home. So why was his car seemingly abandoned there?
So I jumped in my pickup and blew up the highways, probably 8-9 miles away from where the reception was, and come around the corner onto this dirt road and followed the dirt road up. It got narrower, and all of a sudden it turned into a cow path. There was grass in between the tire marks, and I turned the last corner, and there I seen Dad's car. So it was in a mud hole or a mud puddle, mud hole. It wasn't, and it didn't look like it was really stuck. When Dad would get stuck, he didn't stop till he was either had it really stuck or he was out. He would have had the foot to the floorboards, and there would have been mud strung from one end to the other, but it looked like he was drove into the mud puddle and left. Well, I seen the car. I jumped out of the car or out of my truck and ran up to the car to see if he was in there, if anything was in there. And there was the medication that he'd picked up for Mom was still in there. The groceries he'd picked up the day earlier were in there. The window was open and no Dad. I yelled a few times and nothing, didn't hear anything. So I called 911, let them know that where I was at, my location, that I'd meet them out on the highway, that I found their car, and so they were going to send the deputy as soon as possible. I got out to the highway. The first officer was at Staples Town Police, must have heard the 911 feed or something, and was curious what was going on. Well, then the sheriff's deputy pulled up, and I had him follow me in to where the car was, and I guess when we got in there, nobody really thought at first that it even thought possible that it would be a crime scene. So there was no attempt to quarter off the car or to tape off the car. It was a missing persons at this point. It was old guy that got lost. That was kind of a mistake on the police department's side that they didn't think right away that it could have been a crime scene. So when we had volunteers showing up to help us look through the woods, as they'd walk by the car, they'd put their hands on the car and look inside and touch the car. And it came time to try to get any prints off the car. There were so many prints on that car that they couldn't they couldn't find who's belonged to whose, and it was just a mess. So then I told the sheriff deputy that I knew we needed to know what to do, that if I could make a call and I could have 50 people there in 20 minutes to search for Dad. There was a wedding party, and the little town leader was having a festival, and a lot of neighbors and friends there that would have been there to the drop of the hat to help us look for Dad. They weren't real excited about getting too many people there. It was, by this time, it was already 8 o'clock, 9 o'clock on Saturday night. So they had the helicopter come over with the heat-seeking radar on it to see if they could find any body heat signatures over this. The area where I found his car was, it was mostly swamp area. And if you've ever heard of Minnesota, they're the land of 10,000 lakes. Well, there's 10,000 lakes and a million swamps. So it's rough, rough terrain. It's wet and bogs and thick briars and just the worst possible spot to find that car is where we found it. So they had the helicopter checking out the overhead heat signatures. Well, it was the swamp in the middle of end of July. Everything's hot in there. They couldn't pick up no heat signatures. That or he wasn't there, which we kind of feel is the truth. But the next day, it would have been Sunday, we had people started showing up to start searching. And boy, did we have the people. We probably had over 200 neighbors, friends, you know, people in the country that showed up to comb these woods. Comb the woods we did. We'd walk from fingertip to fingertip through the swamp, through the thick briars and the brush. If he was there, we would have seen him. This went on for 2 weeks. We searched fingertip to fingertip. The National Guard was called out to help us find him. Still nothing. We had military. We had search dogs. We had over 50 search dogs out there. They couldn't pick up a trace. They couldn't pick up a scent. They'd pick up a little bit of scent, but they couldn't tell if it was from the car or if it would have been Dad. So, like you say, 2 weeks, we searched this 1 square mile swamp and came up with nothing. We searched some places twice. We'd come up with things that the party searching before had dropped through the way through there. We had business cards, and we found a fire department CB, and just things that were dropped from the prior search we were picking up. So we combed that place good.
As previously stated, family meant everything to Peter. So the notion that he would up and leave everyone whom he loved and loved him in return is not a plausible theory. He was looking forward to the fact that the day after he went missing, he was going to speak at his granddaughter's wedding. There's no way he would miss that. So what happened to Peter on July 24th, 2009? For this episode, we also spoke to Renee, one of Peter's daughters. She doesn't believe that her father just wandered off. She feels as though something far more sinister happened.
I think somebody did something to my dad. I have no clue who or why my dad would stop and pick up a hitchhiker or help somebody who needed help. He had to have stopped for some reason on his way, you know, after he left the grocery store, in order for anybody to have gotten a hold of him and to have the car stashed like that. But it was a whole, you know, kind of a day there that the search wasn't real broad, or was, you know, that it was kind of low key yet. The cops were the only ones, you know, just started to get involved. But yeah, I definitely think somebody did something to him.
According to Renee, it wasn't unlike Peter to offer to help someone he saw in need. Peter and his wife, even though they had many children, also took in many foster kids over the years. Here's Renee speaking about her childhood and what type of person her father was while she was growing up.
There was 11 of us born. My mother lost one of the twins to SIDS or crib death, like in the first or second month of his life. So my sister Desiree, the one older than me, had a twin, but he died. And all of our life, we pretty much said, you know, 10 kids, 5 girls, 5 boys, excluding the twin. Out of the 10 of us, I'm number 9. I've got a younger brother yet. My experience is I had a very happy childhood. Couldn't imagine, you know, life any different than it was. We had horses. We lived on a farm. A lot of work. A lot of togetherness. Being the one of the youngest, I kind of got the easier end of Dad's life early on for the older brothers and sisters. I guess it was a little more difficult. Dad had broken his back at one point. My dad was one of the most kindest-hearted persons.
Renee and the rest of the Ackerman family became accustomed to their parents bringing new people into their home. They had many foster children and would help anyone who just needed a meal.
Knowing my dad, we always had someone, a stranger, at our dinner table. Like if 10 kids to feed wasn't enough, if there was somebody in need, they were there with us. When I was 12, my parents started taking in foster kids. So from 12 to this day, I mean, my mom no longer takes in foster kids, but previous foster kids are still in contact with her. You know, they're still part of the family. So, you know, and my dad had many run-ins with DSHS or, you know, whatever agency that was trying to pull something that he didn't think was quite right. He let him know. My teachers and principals, they knew my dad as, you know, someone who would come in and stand up for his kids if he felt that they were, you know, getting a bad rap on something.
One obvious concern when someone Peter's age goes missing is their health. I was curious as to whether or not he may have had any illness or something that would affect his mental clarity.
He had jaundice, a bit of jaundice, I guess, that he was taking medication for. But other than that, he had recently been and saw the doctor, and the doctor's like, I got good news and bad news for you, Pete. Good news, health is great. Bad news, you're going to live to 100. He walked with a limp. He's had hip surgeries or whatever, so he walked with a cane, you know, just as his extra help. But health-wise, he was no dementia, no sharp as a tack in the mind yet. You can tell he was starting to get tired in his eyes or whatever, you know, how the skin just kind of starts closing in around your eyes and you just got that tired look when you're that old. But other than that, you know, there was no health issues for an 82-year-old.
Peter was well known in town. I wondered if Peter had any recent altercations with anyone or had any enemies in Staples.
I mean, yeah, you saw my dad and had to take a second look at that interesting full-bearded gentleman that wore a French beret and had a cigar stogie out hanging out of his mouth. Dad was well-liked in the country or in the neighborhood or in the area, and he didn't have any real beefs with anybody other than I was told that my dad did some volunteering for the elderly. You know, he's 82, but he's going around the neighborhood bringing food to other elderlies that, you know, don't have a car or can't get in or health issues or whatever. He was picking people up to take them to doctor appointments. So he was well known and visited a lot of people and was on the road a lot. Apparently, he was picking up this little old lady that lived way in nowhere, you know, back on a back road, had a bunch of cats and stinky old house and didn't have access to hardly anything. But she had some old equipment, old farm pieces, stuff like that out in her field. And there was a group of scrappers, I guess, that were coming in and taking some of her things. And I guess they had permission to take a couple of the items, but my dad had caught them coming back and taking more. And he had reported it to the Cass County Sheriff, apparently. And so that could have pissed somebody off. That was their money, their income that Dad stepped into. That's one theory. And those people live right kind of where the car ended up turning off and finding its spot. But also another gal that lives right there across the river, same area. She has a conversation with this kid, kind of related by family, on a messenger, Facebook or something like that. He copied the conversation. And since he lives right there and maybe she knows something, he starts asking her, what happened to the old man, you know, that went missing by your place? And she dodges the question a couple times and he presses some more and some more. And she makes comment that, I'm not the one who shot him, you know, just saying, you know, calling him by name, making some comments that you just, so he presses her a little bit more and then she gets quite angry and offensive and kind of cuts the conversation or, you know, between the two. But she talks about her boyfriend living in Bremerton, Washington, how she lived there with him. But while she was in and out of jail and maybe doing some time somewhere, getting out, staying with her parents in South Dakota, while she's all this is going on, she gets a phone call that her boyfriend out in Bremerton has hung himself. And she goes on to say how some things are better left taken to the grave and just, you know, making odd, strange comments like that before ending the conversation altogether. So that makes me, you know, wonder, okay, this guy that committed suicide, what, you know, what did he do that he's got to take something to the grave with him? Well, looking into it more, you know, I find out that he was in Sturgis, July 2009, and Minnesota, South Dakota, it's right there, hop, skip, and a jump to go see his girlfriend, Holly, which lives in the area that my dad goes missing. They've asked her many questions, and she won't talk to anybody. But meanwhile, she's getting caught consistently all the time with drugs or in jail for one thing or another, but seems to be getting out a lot, too, on these charges. And so I'm not sure what's going on there. I don't know how, if she's not going to talk to him, she's not going to talk to him. I don't know what, you know, you can do at that point with her. I checked into, you know, like this Bremerton guy thing, and, you know, I can't get anywhere on the Bremerton thing because the guy's dead. And so I kind of stopped there. And just there being a few people in that area that are a little shady and that, who knows?
The Vanished is sponsored by BetterHelp. With social gatherings picking up after the winter, it can be easy to ignore your social battery and spread yourself thin. It's a good time to think about the right amount of socializing for you. Maybe you thrive around people, or maybe you prefer more alone time. Therapy can give you the self-awareness to build a social life that doesn't drain your battery. A therapist can help you learn how to set boundaries so you feel empowered to be the best version of yourself. Everyone can benefit from therapy. It's not just for those who've experienced major trauma. So, if you're thinking of starting therapy, give BetterHelp a try. It's entirely online, so it's designed to be convenient, flexible, and suited to your schedule. Just fill out a brief questionnaire to get matched with a licensed therapist and switch therapists anytime for no additional charge. Find your social sweet spot with BetterHelp. Visit BetterHelp.com/vanished today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/vanished.
Imagine upgrading your wardrobe with luxury essentials at unbeatable prices. Quince is here to transform the way you shop with a range of high-quality items priced within reach, like 100% Mongolian cashmere sweaters for $50, organic cotton sweaters, washable silk tops, and timeless 14-karat gold jewelry. The best part, all Quince items are priced 50 to 80% less than similar brands. By partnering directly with top factories, Quince cuts out the cost of the middleman and passes the savings on to us. And I was thrilled to learn that Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing practices and premium fabrics and finishes. I love that. I now have several items from Quince. I love their cardigans, pants, and shirts. I find their pieces to be easy to mix and match, and also to dress up or dress down. Indulge in affordable luxury. Go to quince.com/vanished for free shipping on your order and 365-day returns. That's quince.com/vanished to get free shipping and 365-day returns. quince.com/vanished. With any disappearance, people are bound to theorize and even spread rumors as to what happened to the individual in question. Renee has heard many statements regarding her father and his whereabouts.
I've also heard a lot of awful things, you know, how rumors go when somebody's missing or someone died. You know, people start spreading rumors and who knows what truth is where and who knows. And I mean, I've heard from maybe your dad lost your mom to he got chopped up in the wood chopper because of a bad drug deal that a nephew had with someone, you know. And then you hear rumors like, oh, your dad put up one hell of a fight, or, you know, what you really want to hear. Someone beat him to death or shot him that he, you know, put up one hell of a fight at 82 years old. Who takes an 82-year-old and hurts him anyway? If somebody had gotten to my dad and they started, you know, pushing him around or giving him orders or something, my dad would have, you little bastard, what the hell do you think you're, you know, he would right away stand up for himself.
The search for Peter was extensive, and it didn't turn up a single clue. As the days went on without finding Peter, the family began to believe that the area in which Peter's car was found was just a place to discard the vehicle. They don't believe that Peter was ever actually there.
It was probably on day two of the search that my brother Mike came up to me and said out loud that, I don't think Dad's here. I don't think he ever was here. So from that point on, we were searching, knowing or feeling that we weren't going to find anything anyway. We didn't know where to start to look. You'd think you start by the car. Well, we started by the car, but if the car was possibly dumped there, where are you going to look then?
Same as Renee, Jurg stated that Peter didn't have any serious enemies within the area that would have wanted to cause him any type of harm.
But he never had enemies that would want to harm him. He'd maybe come across a neighbor every once in a while that he didn't feel was dealing fairly with him, that he would not agree with or would have words with, but never anything that constituted any reason to do him harm. I think somebody came across him. I don't know if it would be a stranger in the country or somebody local, but came across him and either mistook him for somebody else. Somebody did something to him. I think it had to have been somebody in the area that knew the area to be able to hide something, you know, hide a body or hide any evidence in that kind of conditions. I mean, you had to, if somebody dumped the car there, they would have had to walk out, or they would have had to have somebody pick them up. And they'd have to be pretty confident. That road, usually Dad's route would take him from the farm, which is in Leader, take him, he would usually go first to Motley, and he'd be straight south. And then if you need to go to Staples would be 7 miles west of Motley. Well, that day he went to Motley first and then to Staples. But he usually take the same route home back to Motley and then up the state highway to 20 miles north to the farm. Dad's car was found off of a cut across that goes from Staples to that state highway about a mile north of Motley. So you can cut off 2 miles off your trip to the farm from Staples if you take this shortcut. But Dad he very rarely ever took that shortcut. The other way was the way he'd usually take, and he'd usually go to Motley first anyway. He had business in Motley, so that was generally the road he would take. So we were kind of surprised to find his car over off of that road anyway. And the cut across road, there is a highway that goes north right next to the river. About a mile up that highway, it has a sharp curve to the west, and there's a dirt road on your right going to the east, and that is the dirt road that turns into the minimum maintenance road where the car was left.
At the end of Peter's memoir, he discussed his death and what his funeral wishes would be. He stated, "Quite often, I entertain the thoughts about dying. As a young child, I would have liked to have been a martyr. As a young man, I thought about dying as a freedom fighter or a soldier. As a father, I thought about dying in some kind of service for the family. Now that I'm old and worn out, I hope to experience a peaceful death at home. My hope is that in dying, I will be able to have my family around me, and that for my loved ones, it will be a positive experience. I would like to be coherent and in my right mind until the end, so that I have a chance to prepare myself. If I should die of cancer or another hard illness, I hope to be able to withstand all the pain. I hope that I could be able to be without drugs for a longer time. I would like to visit my family with a full mind, to say thank you to all and leave them all my love. I also would like to be able to plan my funeral, which I have talked about with family on and off. I would like to have a plain funeral without spending a lot of money. A funeral without fanfare or false pretense. A plain coffin carried by my sons and daughters. A simple celebration and a grave shoveled by my family and neighbors. Afterwards, there should be a plain meal to show gratitude for the helpers, friends, and family. If it's in the summer, there should be a keg of beer. If it's in the winter, there should be a hot alcoholic beverage. It is my wish that all the costs be shared by my family members. Since all of the work and tasks will be performed by my family, those costs won't be too high. If the family chooses to have a viewing, it should be done on the farm and not in a funeral home. The family should take the coffin by car or pickup truck to the church, to the cemetery, and together lower it into the grave. My hope is that the main feelings or beliefs of all should be thankfulness for the good years, forgiveness of past weaknesses, and the knowledge of eternal life." 7 years after Peter's disappearance, he was officially declared deceased. In August of 2018, Peter's family had a funeral for him to celebrate his life. Even though it was not how he intended for things to happen, the family did their best to grant his wishes. Renee spoke about how her mother has been holding up over the past 9 years without Peter.
Oh, well, you know, Mom's doing pretty good, actually, for going through that and now having to bury him or have a funeral for him, I guess, a service. There's no burial, but it's been hard for her. She, you know, lost her soulmate of 50-plus years, and, yeah, they were just in love all the time, giving each other gooses or pinching one another, holding hands, or, you know, a good role model as parents goes, or, you know, relationship goes for kids. You know, everybody still has a real hard time with it, a struggle with accepting it or the unknown stories or truth. And the funeral was just because we all felt Dad deserved one, you know, and that we shouldn't wait any longer because of Mom's getting up there in age. There's 7 years difference between my parents, Mom being younger, but now she's in her mid-80s and she don't move as well, but she's, you know, for being diabetic and overweight, she does real well. But yeah, no, she cries every night.
It's now going on 10 years since Peter Ackerman went missing. The investigation is still open. However, there's been little to no movement in the case.
We try to keep in touch with the investigator, but, you know, after 9 years of nothing changing, it gets to be kind of monotonous trip up, you know, we're 50 or miles or better away from the county seat, so to go up to the sheriff's department takes us a half day, three quarters of a day wasted. It's not wasted, but we know what they're going to tell us. You know, they can only tell us that it's that they have leads or they don't have leads, or they can't tell you anything about any of the leads. So we don't know what their thoughts are, or who they suspect, if they suspect anybody, or, you know, they can't let us know or it'll get out. Simple truth. Personally, I don't think it's going anywhere. Personally, I think they probably just gave up by now. You know, it's been 9 years. They can't find the old guy. It's tax dollars got to go somewhere else. You know, I don't think it's not a top priority anymore by any means.
So what happened to Peter Ackerman on July 24th, 2009, after he picked up some groceries and his wife's prescriptions? Did Peter have some kind of medical emergency that caused him to become confused, getting his car stuck, and he wandered off, never to be found? We know he didn't have any serious medical issues at the time, but could something spontaneous have happened? If that's the case, why was no trace of Peter found during extensive searches? How far could a man who needed a cane to walk have gotten? Sometimes we hear of cases where someone is found in an area that had previously been searched, so it isn't completely out of the realm of possibility, but it's still strange. Or did something far more sinister happen to Peter? Could he have been targeted because he was older and vulnerable? Is it as his family believes, that Peter was never in the area where the car was found? That was simply just a dump site to throw off the search. After 9.5 long years, Peter's case is just as much of a mystery as it was on that beautiful summer day that he disappeared. Peter Ackerman was last seen on July 24, 2009 in Staples, Minnesota. At the time of his disappearance, he was 82 years old. He had gray hair and brown eyes, a full salt and pepper beard. He weighed about 170 pounds and stood at 5'7" tall. He was last seen wearing a tan and brown button-down shirt, cargo pants, and a red, white, and blue crocheted beret hat. He was also known to walk with a cane and wear glasses. Other distinguishable characteristics include his distinct accent from his home country of Switzerland, a birthmark on the back of his neck, and he had a full set of dentures. There is currently a $20,000 reward offered for information that leads to an arrest and conviction of any person responsible for Peter's disappearance. If you have any information regarding the whereabouts of Peter Ackerman, please contact the Cass County Sheriff's Office at 1-800-450-2677 or 218-547-1424.
It's been 9 years, but it's just as hard as it was the day I found out. You know, I still don't know what happened to my dad.
You know, if we're in a small community and, you know, we know everybody or we know people that do know everybody, that it's really hard not to, if you have a suspicion, that you don't start any hard feelings in the whole country. So it's not just a missing persons problem. It's a PR problem. It's everything is, you know, trying to find dad could alienate everybody in the country. If you believe one person's guilty, then there's nothing easy about it. Puts you against your neighbors, it puts you against law enforcement. You don't know who to trust, you don't know what to believe. I don't know if I'll ever have the answers. I hope and pray that somebody'll slip up and say something, but after 9 years, hope is getting pretty dim.
That brings us to the end of episode 157. I'd like to thank Renee and Jurg for taking the time to speak with us for the show. If you have a missing loved one that you'd like to have featured on the show, there's a case submission form at thevanishedpodcast.com. If you'd like to contact me, there's a page and a discussion group on Facebook. I'm on Twitter at thevanishedpod and also on Instagram. If you enjoy this show, subscribe now and leave a 5-star review on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Stitcher, Wondery.com, or wherever you're listening right now. Do you want to help support the show? There's a couple things that you can do. One way to help The Vanished is by supporting our sponsors. You can find links and promo codes in the episode notes. Another way to support the show is by filling out a short survey at Wondery.com/survey. Join me next week. I'll be covering a case from Arizona. Thanks for listening.
You know how to book flights and hotels. All you're missing is a tool to plan the travel experiences you'll have once you arrive. That's why you need Viator. Book guided tours, activities, excursions, and more in one place to make your trip truly unforgettable. Viator has over 300,000 travel experiences to choose from. Everything from simple tours to extreme adventures and all the niche, interesting stuff in between. So you can plan something that everyone you're traveling with will enjoy. Real traveler reviews give the inside scoop from people who've already been on the experiences you're considering, so you can plan with confidence. Free cancellation helps you plan for the unexpected, and 24/7 customer support means you can travel worry-free. Download the Viator app now and use code Viator10 for 10% off your first booking in the app. Find travel experiences for you. Do more with Viator.
Murder on My Mind, a new podcast available exclusively on Wondery Plus, explores the circumstances leading up to the murder of two young men and the mistrials of the man accused of killing them. Up-and-coming rapper YNW Melly gained notoriety in the hip-hop world for his shocking lyrics and criminal exploits. When two of his best friends were gunned down in a drive-by shooting, investigators suspected the young rapper staged the scene. But after not one, but two trials that ended in hung juries and new evidence that may place YNW Melly at the scene of the crime, his trial has been paused indefinitely. With countless twists and turns, Law & Crime covers all angles of the case and begs the question, is this young artist the victim of a witch hunt or a silver-tongued devil who's evil to the core? Listen to Murder on My Mind exclusively and ad-free on Wondery Plus. Join Wondery Plus in the Wondery app or on Apple Podcasts.